Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. Discussions are built on slow reading and attentiveness to ideas. You can tune in wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can receive updates by following me on Blue Sky or LinkedIn. I was delighted to finally meet and also interview David Scott for Countersign in June of this year while he was visiting Birkbeck to give the inaugural Bonnard Lecture. I had been introduced to David Scott's work by our mutual and sadly departed dear friend Malathi D'Alves, also an anthropologist, when I was visiting Sri Lanka nearly 20 years ago. David is currently working on a biography of Stuart Hall, and that was the subject of his Bonnard Lecture. Although we touch on the incredible power and influence of Stuart Hall's life and work and its obvious relevance for the main topic that we discuss, the primary focus of our conversation is the problem of reparations for New World slavery, or transatlantic slavery as it's also called. Among his many insights, provocations, and lessons, Stuart Hall taught us how to think a new conjuncture. And when we see the current moment replete with demands for reparations for colonialism and New World slavery, we have to ask ourselves, why now? Why does reparations present itself as a post-colonial and decolonial problem in the current moment? As David explains, we are living now in the time which is the aftermath of a collapse of more radical and revolutionary horizons that had animated the time of decolonization in the 1950s to 1970s. And what followed was a period of neoliberalism, devices such as transitional justice, human rights, and international law as the response to traumatic events or to great violence. And of course, those devices have also now failed us. And so this is a time once again when the relationship between past, present, and future is being renegotiated. And the focus on reparations is one symptom and device of the terms of that renegotiation. Among the many thinkers that David is in conversation with in his book Irreparable Evil is Hannah Arendt. And for Arendt, the Holocaust of European Jews was a catastrophe to which there could be no juridical response. One couldn't reconcile oneself or follow the Holocaust with a form of reconciliation. And this is the insight that David also brings to bear on New World slavery, which he regards as irreparable and yet in need of redress. So once one determines that a ruinous moment, a process of genocide and destruction of forms of life cannot be redressed, one has to think about the openings that need to be created to go on living with this past. And it is those kinds of questions that we address in our conversation. David Scott is a Ruth and William Lubick Professor in the Department of Anthropology at Columbia University. He's the author of over 7 books and the founder and editor of the journal Small Axe, which is the premier journal of the Caribbean and African diaspora, and he's also the director of the Small Axe Project. As I mentioned, David was in London to give the inaugural Bonnard Lecture, And we're incredibly grateful to the Bonnard Trust, which supports scholarships at UK universities for research at postgraduate level into the nature of racial, religious, and cultural intolerance with a view to finding means to combat them. And it is with enormous gratitude to their support for David's visit that we now get on with our conversation. David Scott, welcome to Countersign. I'm so delighted to be talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
You were giving the inaugural Bonnard lecture last night at Birkbeck, a lecture titled Growing Echoes in His Head, Thinking Through the Prism of Stuart Hall's Life. Now, we will come to talking about the influence and the many conversations that you've had with Stuart Hall, whose work and insights are very present in your own work. But I wanted to start with your most recent book, Irreparable Evil, An Essay in Moral and Reparatory History. And this book has come out in a historical moment when there are many and growing calls for reparations for New World slavery. Most recently, Ghana sponsored a General Assembly resolution to have it recognized that transatlantic slavery was the greatest of crimes. And you will know that while there was widespread support, the former colonial powers, including Britain, abstained from this resolution. And one of the reasons that Britain gave is that when New World slavery was taking place, and Britain participated extensively in it and gained enormous wealth from the trafficking and the terror visited upon African peoples. The British view today is that it was legal at the time, and that is one of the reasons that they gave, or it wasn't illegal in international law. The fact that there is a call for reparations suggests that there is a wider political moment where the relationship between the present and the past is being visited and relitigated in various institutions. How do you enter this discussion about reparations and the irreparable in relation to New World slavery?
Thank you, Stuart. Needless to say, that's a very tough, complicated question. It's not surprising that the former colonial powers abstained from the vote on the floor of the General Assembly, and that in whatever casuistic way the former colonial powers are going to seek to not acknowledge responsibility for the past of New World slavery. But I nevertheless think it's an important attempt to bring the past of New World slavery to the floor of the General Assembly as a matter of the widening of the debate about the debt, if you like, owed, the moral debt, and perhaps also the material debt that's owed to the former colonized, by the former colonizing powers. However, it seems to me reasonably clear that insofar as international law remains the terrain on which the matter is being debated, insofar as litigation is the technique through which the question is raised and discussed, that there will be, in a certain sense, nowhere to go. It seems to me that the past of New World slavery and what's to be done in the present for a different kind of future is going to be settled politically and not simply legally. And as you know, I'm sure better than me, however much international law became in the 1990s a seemingly robust domain of transaction and dispute resolution in the context of international human rights law in particular, we now no longer live in that conjuncture. And as we see around the world today, international law has very, very, very little purchase. So that's the first part of the question you asked. This is a long set of knotty problems for me, because in a certain respect, the question of reparations for me emerges very directly in the context of, in the discursive context, if you like, of the demise of the purchase of the concept of revolution as a way of thinking about the relationship, the temporal relationship and the transformatively temporal relationship between pasts of domination, exploitation, and injury, and thinking about what kinds of possible futures might be imagined. And I have written about this quite a bit in the wake of Irreparable Evil, in which I'm trying to think about what I call, and I do talk about it, I think, quite briefly here, the relationship between the loss of certain kinds of concepts and potentially the gain of new kinds of concepts. And what's to me conceptually worth exploring is the senses in which reparation transforms the terrain of thinking about the relationship between past, present, and futures, and lends itself potentially to different ways of thinking about subjects, subjectivity, harm, injury, trauma, and what to do with those kinds of pasts in the current moment in relation to thinking different kinds of futurity. So there is a conceptual dimension to the way in which, for me, reparation is a question worth thinking about. But reparation also comes to me in the context of trying to think about a book that I published a number of years ago, entitled "Omens of Adversity," which was perhaps the first time that I tried to think carefully about what kinds of concepts are coming to the fore in the aftermath of the collapse of the dream of revolution. And that book thinks about the aftermath of the Grenada Revolution and the rise of the aggressive rise of neoliberalism, transitional justice, international law as the terrain of dispute resolution, etc., etc. And it's an inside of that conjuncture, if you like, or that problem space, that the terms of a different way of thinking about what the past is in relation to the future became more and more apparent to me and seemed to require a new kind of thinking. And obviously, for someone like myself, born when and where I was born and growing up when and where I grew up, the fundamental problem about the past, the sustaining and forever problem about the past, is that of New World slavery. So tackling that question and finding a methodological way of rethinking the problem about New World slavery in the past seemed to me an urgent set of questions to grapple with.
So you were born and grew up in Jamaica.
Yes.
And you're deeply formed by the political debates and horizons that were available when you were growing up. And this came in the wake of a period of formal decolonization, but the continuation of neoliberal forms of extraction, the fact that there were local elites that continued to collaborate with the former colonial powers, and the failures of a certain kind of idea of the development of nation states after formal imperialism. So that's the setting and context from which you're thinking about these issues. And when we think about the, you know, looking back at those moments from the current moment, we're also grappling with a kind of melancholia for the loss of those horizons. So that I also see as a persistent theme in your thinking and writing, this tension between the fact of a longing for something that is not going to produce the conditions of freedom and equality and the ability to thrive that people would hope for, and how to respond to that loss of a horizon. Now, you take this up in an incredibly dramatic way at the beginning of Irreparable Evil in your reference to Jonathan Lear's Radical Hope, and how he recounts how the Crow chief Plenty Coup confronted the loss of a way of life, a form of life, as he had to negotiate with the expansion of the colonial wars and dispossession of indigenous peoples in the United States. And part of what, you know, this extraordinary phrase that is recounted from Plenty Coup, the Crow chief, who says, after the buffalo were gone,
the hearts of my people fell to the ground.
The hearts of my people fell to the ground, but also after the buffalo were gone, nothing happened.
Right.
And when he says nothing happened, it's not that he didn't go on to do many things and that he didn't lead his people through an extremely challenging period. And in fact, he was a person of action, a person who spoke with presidents and was present as a leader of his community. And at the same time, there's a sense of a kind of irreparable loss that is manifested in that moment. So I wonder how those, I wanted you to sort of expand on how those themes of the loss of a form of life informs your thinking about futurity, actually, because that is the sense in which one's ability to think about an alternative future manifests itself in the moment of this deep loss.
You know, I want to go back to something you said a moment earlier about the location, my own location in relation to Jamaica, because it's important, and I will come back to to Lear and Radical Hope, because one of the concepts that drives me in a variety of different dimensions of my work is that of generations, and this is an idea that emerged for me very, very powerful in the context of the interviews that I have conducted and that were published in Small Axe, because In the context of those interviews, it became manifestly clear to me that my generation, which is the generation that didn't know the colonial period, I am the first generation to grow up in post-colonial Jamaica, and to be taught in school, and particularly at the university, by members of an earlier generation who formed the core of the radical transformatory projects of the 1970s. I was taught by, you know, members of the Communist Party, the Workers' Party of Jamaica, and so I am living there the horizon of socialist possibility, mm-hmm. and live simultaneously the ruin of that project. And so the question of horizons of possibility, of hope, and the ruin, the collapse of those hopes, has in many ways formed the generational sensibility that I inherit. And so that's very, very important to me. And thinking about the question of collapse, of ruin, of kinds of ending, has shaped multiple dimensions of what I try to think about, which is partly why Jonathan Lair's book felt so resonant for me, and the way in which he tries to conjure a specific, what he thinks of as an ontological register, in which the human condition can find itself in a place in which its conceptual imaginary can no longer get hold of the new world in which it is obliged to act. There's a lot to say about that book and a lot to say about its misunderstanding and the attacks that it has suffered on the part of people who who I respect, and people whose views are shaped by critical perspectives that I have some degree of regard for. But it's interesting that so many people missed the fact that Lair lamentably he died earlier this year or late last year, not naive about the question of the colonial, the political dimensions of what he's trying to get at, but he is determined to try to open up for us a register in which it is worth speculating at what kind of life could be embedded in the utterance that after a particular event, one might say that nothing happened. Because, of course, we know, quote, anthropologically, that statement comes to us via the mm-hmm. writer, the white, one might imagine him as an anthropologist taking notes from Plenty Coupes, and it is through him that this idea that after the buffalo went away, nothing happened. But Lair is very careful to say that what he's interested in is a philosophical, anthropological speculation, that this kind of statement raises deep questions about mm-hmm. about the human condition. And it was such a revelatory way of thinking for me, given all of its Wittgensteinian resonances, etc., to do with how one thinks about the limits of language, etc., because it raises for me the imaginary of those enslaved people who were kidnapped and transshipped to a future of which they could have no understanding, that of which they would not have had the conceptual vocabulary to even conceive of, and who therefore had to rebuild, if you like, from the ground up, the epistemological resources out of which they conceived their lives, which is, in another way, the entire language of creolization. But, and so it's inside of that knotty problem of the human condition that Jonathan Lear's book spoke to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a large debate inside of the the New World slavery debates, whether or not, to what extent the enslaved brought various kinds of knowledges from the African continent, and undoubtedly they did. But what their conceptual imaginary would not have had the resources to be able to produce a counter discourse for was the new form of life into which they were being inserted coercively.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that seems to me very crucial to think about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's key notions of collapse, ruin, forms of ending that you've just referred to. Makes me think of a number of things. The ongoing genocide and genocides that we're witnessing in Palestine right now, and how one responds to what, on the one hand, may be characterized as irreparable, but at the same time requires redress. And this is a kind of paradox that goes through your
yes.
book. And I'm thinking here about the different ways and registers in which you and Stuart Hall might address this problem. And in fact, in your extraordinarily beautiful epistolary homage and conversation with Stuart Hall in the book Stuart Hall's Voice, the chapter on contingency, I think, reveals the different orientations of your thinking around the notion of finitude. And Stuart Hall's openness, as you put it, to a certain form of practice and political practice. Now, finitude also manifests an openness because it's an exposure, and you, in various places, refer to Jean-Luc Nancy's work, and someone who's one of the great philosophers of finitude. So I wanted you to talk about how we find openness amidst the extraordinary, constraining, asphyxiating closures of these moments and events, and indeed processes, because genocides are not events, they're processes, they're ongoing. How you approach that question of ruin and openness amidst the ruin, and how you might compare that to how Stuart Hall addressed that question. And that is also a very big question. I'm sorry.
It is. That's fine. It's a challenging question, but it is indeed what preoccupies me. But I want to begin with irreparability. In a certain sense, I mean, I indicated a moment ago that generations was my preoccupation. But generations is my preoccupation partly because it is a temporal concept.
Mm-hmm.
And what, at sort of a wide level, what obsesses me is the question of temporality.
Mm-hmm.
The way in which one might think about temporalities in respect of pastnesses, presentnesses, futurities, And the ruptures and possibilities and closures and so forth that through which one might think about and indeed rethink temporality. And irreparability, to my mind, inhabits this field of problems and therefore also the moral idea of evil. It seems to me enormously important for us to be able to face up to the catastrophic effects of events and processes that have left marks on humanity that are not fixable. And that pasts, unlike the ways in which a certain kind of Marxism wanted to think about the relationship between past, present, and futures, and indeed the ways in which certain kinds of modernist conceptions of progressive temporality imagined in a certain sense that the past could be overcome on the way to a future that would transcend the damage of the past. I think that that's a false hope. And therefore, we have to face the fact that there are pasts, there are wounds that will not heal. And however we make our way into a possible future, we are going to have to carry the baggage, the moral baggage of pasts in which we are implicated as victims or beneficiaries or perpetrators and so on. And that seems to me important for being able to face what is irreparable and to face also the challenge of thinking futurities in the context of what is the irreparable damage of pasts of evil. So that's very, very important to me, and very important to me as a way of coming back to the question of the political.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps we will come to this in another part of the conversation, because one of the texts through which I'm thinking again about the question of revolution and the question of reparation is through a rereading of Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, and I've written some about that. But so this conception is driven by a conceptual demand that we take the moral seriously as not an end in itself, but a way of addressing questions that are often too quickly subsumed by the fetishization of the political, the idea that the political is the be-all and end-all of where responsible thinking should be carried on. And although the question of the political and the horizon of different kinds of political possibilities is important for me, getting a grasp on what the contemporary moral issues are and how to think about the changed character of the circumstances in which these questions emerge, and how in that context to recognize that there are injuries and modes of the commission of injuries, the genocides that you mentioned a while ago, that are not, the implications of which are not simply transcendable.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the political resolutions of those questions, and there have to be political resolutions, are going to have to be imagined in the context of the wounds that those obscenities have left. Where is the overcoming of the loss that those parents have suffered in Gaza? Where is the healing of those children who have lost limbs, etc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
there are irreparable wounds. Mm-hmm. And any political attempt to address those will have to face those very, very difficult moral questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm struck in the book of your, really intense engagement with Hannah Arendt, with whom you don't entirely agree, but nonetheless, this is an important framing of the irreparable and Hannah Arendt's treatment of the Holocaust that is the greatest crime, the crime that cannot be, in fact, addressed in the register of crime. And it is, in fact, the impossibility of seeing it in a sort of juridical register of a crime that can be punished that renders it something with which one cannot reconcile oneself. You know, these are harms, injuries in relation to which one cannot be reconciled, that humanity cannot reconcile itself to such a great crime. Now, I wanted to introduce there the figure of and the work of Jacques Derrida on forgiveness, where Derrida's argument in relation to the enormity of the problem of forgiveness was that it was only the unforgivable that is worthy of forgiveness. And that was the great tension, in a sense, Derrida was arguing in opposition to Yankelevich and Hannah Arendt. So I'm just thinking about the register in which Hannah Arendt came at the problem of the irreconcilable and the irreparable, and how your approach is distinct from hers.
Well, you know, Arendt is a large figure for me, and a good deal of what irritated me in the book Irreparable Evil was the kind of campy interpretations of Arendt that are so prevalent, mm-hmm. And the ways in which Arendt is locked into a certain very clear set of parameters of interpretive intelligibility that seem to me to gloss over a good deal of what, to my mind, is important about the range of work from the origins of totalitarianism through the human condition, through the last work on willing and thinking and so forth. But I also wanted to recognize the areas of Arendt's thinking that were themselves awash with kinds of blindness and prejudice and so forth. So that mm-hmm. was also very important to me.
Especially in the context of the civil rights movement.
Yes.
And her comments in the 1960s.
Yes. Her inability to grasp the human condition of peoples of African descent in the New World, mm-hmm. to put it this way, the inability out of her own sensibility for the dilemma of the burden of Jewish history and the condition of Jewish people, to recognize the condition of suffering and hope of Black people in the Americas, which is not entirely surprising, but it registers the ways in which a certain kind of normativity of whiteness mm-hmm. became one of the modalities through which she adjusted to being an American, mm-hmm. a white mm-hmm. woman in America. And that is a dimension of Arendt that is largely left out of the critical discourse around Arendt, which is, to my mind, a great pity and a loss in a certain kind of critical judgment. What's arresting is Arendt's attempt to evoke the surprise, in some sense, the what appeared to her generation to be so irreconcilable about the attempted destruction of European Jewry. And what it was about that attempted destruction that seemed unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
In many respects, of course, it was not
mm-hmm.
unprecedented, which mm-hmm. is part of her own blindness.
But
mm-hmm. And how to think about processes, eventual processes, that are of such a character that, as Arendt puts it, it would have been better for the perpetrators to simply be thrown into the sea. There is nothing to be done
mm-hmm.
About them. There is no forgiveness to be had. There is no punishment that can rise to trying to grapple with mm-hmm. the enormity of that. And she has something there which I think is very important, and which in relation to which I think that although there is much in the humanism of that moment, that late moment in Derrida's preoccupation, the preoccupation with friendship, with cosmopolitanism, mm-hmm. with forgiveness and so forth, there is something in that gesture which I think is entirely worthy. And at various kinds of in various kinds of in the capacity of an individual, one might be able to make a gesture of forgiveness. But the question of the Holocaust and the question of New World slavery are not matters about individuals simply.
Mm-hmm.
They are systemic matters. They are structural matters, which have to do with the construction, with the destruction of ways of life, and the construction of new modes of life into which peoples have been inserted and obliged to live differently than their ancestors had done. And in that context, what is the gesture of forgiveness?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's an empty gesture. And the philosopher whose work I engage in this respect is Lawrence Mordecai Thomas, who mm-hmm. has also passed away, alas. And he's also very interested in the question of forgiveness. Again, a dimension of his work with which I disagree, the gesture that but for the grace of God I could be there
mm-hmm.
and you could be here,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is an insight that is profoundly important for all of us to grapple with, something about the contingency of the human condition, the question of luck, etc.,
mm-hmm.
all of which are important ways of thinking about the condition of human fragility, the question of tragedy in the human condition, and so on. But the descendants of those who were enslaved and who today suffer the consequences of that historic obscenity are not going to be able to cash the gesture
mm-hmm.
That they forgive Europe for what they did, for what Europe did to their
mm-hmm.
To their forebears, and therefore, to my mind, the idea that one must be able to forgive the unforgivable is the conceit of a certain kind of privilege of a European condition.
And, of course, a conceit that is unraveling in South Africa and a number of other places where it has been deployed, where gestures of reconciliation and forgiveness without addressing the systemic and structural elements that you were just referring to, where they have not been addressed, then the harms continue, the evil continues, as it were. Now we're coming close to the end of our time, and you've been very generous with your time. You mentioned tragedy, and of course it is a literary form, a form of narrative that has pervaded your work and thinking. And the ability to story the past, and to story the past through particular literary forms, is a central part of doing this historical work, but it's also a fundamental part of the moral challenge of being able to provide a moral response to this enormous violence. And so I wanted you to speak about how you bring the literary form of tragedy to bear on these problems.
Well, the literary is a preoccupation.
Yes.
But if you are, as I am, attentive to form, it's unavoidable in a certain sense that one takes the literary seriously, and the formal, structural, rhetorical components of the literary as a way of understanding narrative, narratology, and the way in which and what's available as a resource for telling or retelling, casting or recasting the story of the past in relation to the present and the future. So yes, all over my work in different ways, the literary is very self-consciously present. The question of tragedy and of the tragic as a mode of emplotment, as Hayden White would have put it, you know, but was important in trying to think again about what C.L.R. James understood himself to be doing in relation to the account of Toussaint Louverture that he provides in The Black Jacobins. And it was fascinating and fundamental to me that James was very keenly aware, even before he recast the last paragraphs of the last chapter of The Black Jacobins in relation to the question of the tragic, was all through the 1950s very, very keenly thinking through the tragic, as he talked about Hamlet, as he thought about Melville's Moby Dick, as he thought and rethought the question of Aeschylus and Aeschylus's relationship to Sophocles and the various forms of the tragic that they were experimenting with. And it, you know, reading this work, it was fascinating to me that here was James, a revolutionary, a former Trotskyist, trying to think again in the context of the aftermath of the defeats that, of the hopes that he had through the late 1930s and early 1940s, trying to find a representational mode through which to picture the possibilities of the past in relation to the present and the future differently. Mm-hmm. And that was very arresting to me, and it was one of the vectors through which, you know, I tried to come at a rereading of James and indeed rereading various other texts in the work that I have done subsequently. But the question of the tragic for me, and it's been really important to reiterate, that the tragic for me is not simply a new master key with which to open the door of historical retelling. The question of the tragic alerts one, or should alert one, to the need to recognize the tropology of the rhetorics that we are trying to employ in rereading the past in relation to the present and in rewriting the story of new kinds of historical possibility. And thus in rereading Eric Williams's Capitalism and Slavery in Irreparable Evil, it was enormously important to recognize the role of other kinds of tropes and figures, and in particular in the question of irony and the role of those other kinds of tropes in doing something with historical narrative. But there are many, many wider senses in which the tragic plays a role. As I mentioned last evening, how to think about Hall in relation to the question of the tragic. Why is it that, in some sense, aware as he was always to the question of the tragic, even in the ways in which his interests in Henry James and Henry James's casting of some of his women characters as tragic figures in his novels were dimensions of literary employment that Hall was very aware of. But if you are or someone for whom the immediate impulse is the demand to open up in the immediate present new kinds of strategic political possibility, it's understandable in a certain sense that the tragic recedes in as much as the tragic appears to constrain one's ability or one's willingness to sign on to a political project of one form or another. And I think that's very, very important, and which should alert one, to my mind, to the fact that the tragedy is not some kind of new key, but a way of opening space and a way of shifting the terms of the moral discourse so that new kinds of openings and new kinds of political possibility can surface, and in which one has the vocabulary through which to make new kinds of decisions.
No, I think that puts it really nicely, and I was going to come to Stuart Hall as a way of at least for now bringing this conversation to an end. Is that Stuart Hall's strong sense of responding to the political,
in a political
register. And wanting to identify new conjunctures and to articulate that in a way that was not, a sort of dogmatic left position, but to be really treating the newness of the situation. That meant that a sort of sensibility of the tragic would recede, but that didn't mean that he wasn't attentive in various other works and to the tragic. You're working on Stuart Hall's biography, and of course biography is another story form, and is another way of doing history, and is a particular mode of writing. And you spoke last night in the Bonnard Lecture about a very young Stuart Hall who, is 22 years old and is just extraordinary in his range of reference and engagement with the scholars who surrounded him at the time in Oxford, but also in his moments of return to the Caribbean and confronting this role of being a Caribbean intellectual and the sort of tensions that manifested. So just in closing, I thought I would ask you to just say a little bit about that work of biography, because you, I think, quite rightly put Hall amongst some extraordinary figures in history, Franz Fanon, Wittgenstein, Hannah Arendt, whose biographies and biographers you also referenced. So how are you approaching these many Stuart Halls in this biography?
I suppose one way of coming at that provocation is to say what I said in the lecture, which is that the biographical form offers me one way of evading theory. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my work mm-hmm. has been concerned with managing defying the demand for a kind of theoreticism, if you like.
Can you say why? Why evade theory? And well, you've just said theoreticism, which suggests something about it, but yeah.
Yes. So, you know, the idea of the conceit of theory mm-hmm. has been a real mm-hmm. worry
right.
All over my work. The idea that in whatever form, in its post-structuralist form, in its structuralist form, in its Marxist forms, etc., the assumption that there are propositional frameworks in which, through in one way or another, one can arrive at a certain kind of truth form is to me delusional mm-hmm. to begin with, but it also there's another dimension to this which is its Eurocentrism mm-hmm. And its demand therefore that what one has to reach for or reach into are the supposed centers of theoretical production, and to borrow from these centers of theoretical production the propositional frameworks that will lead one mm-hmm. from point A to point B. And I think that that is, it is to participate in and to reproduce the hierarchy of knowledge production that one has inherited, mm-hmm. Which is, to my mind, worth refusing mm-hmm. to participate in. And biography as a way of producing illumination and clarification rather than truth mm-hmm. seems to me to be another narrative form that enables one to set aside the conceit of theory. And what's very interesting to me about Stuart Hall is that the idea of clarification is all over his work. His late formulations that, you know, he's not interested in theory, he's interested in going on theorizing, mm-hmm. the sort of processual character of his mode of being the intellectual he was, is something that to my mind is a very attractive dimension of his work. So I have been, yes, in trying to get a handle on what I want to do with this biography inside of the debates about how to write biography, what the virtues and value of biography might be, what's entailed in life writing, in casting a life in an intelligible form, and how one relates a life to its work, and work to the life that carries, that inspires, that shapes that work, has been my current obsession, and how, in that context, to think about as I partly was trying to do last evening, the what we know of the mature thinking of the subject of the biography, in this case Stuart Hall, and the emergent ways of formulating kinds of questions, in this case about culture or about difference. And that too, for me, you know, is a way of defamiliarizing Stuart Hall, if you like. That there is, you know, it's always been fascinating to me, Stuart, that, you know, I was never Stuart Hall's student. I don't grow up through debates in Britain, although I'm familiar with them as a post-colonial subject, if you like. And therefore, in a certain sense, I'm not held captive to a certain British allure of Stuart Hall. You know, the figure of that figure that belongs in a certain sense to the important heritage of cultural studies here in Britain. So in some ways, it you know, when I meet that figure of Hall as the doyen of cultural studies, it's not for me an allure. The question that arises, or the question that arose for me in that context was, well, how did that happen? You know, what's the relationship between who was Stuart Hall before Stuart Hall, if you like, and how did he get from one Stuart Hall to the other? There's a very interesting moment in the lecture that I am referring to, the lecture he gave in Jamaica in 2004, in which he talks about coming upon this guy called Stuart Hall that people are talking about. And who is he? I sort of know him, but not entirely. And it's that the kind of reification of a certain kind of figure that belongs to a story of cultural studies that he meets and is trying to understand. So I'm interested in that journey that he's making, and enormously important dimensions of that journey are made through his relationship to Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And obviously, since I have a relationship to Jamaica, I'm very interested in that story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, brilliant. Well, speaking of relationships to places, we both have a relationship to Sri Lanka,
indeed,
which we haven't spoken about, and maybe we can on another occasion. But I can't end our conversation without mentioning our dear late friend Malathi de Alvis, who brought your work to my attention as we sat on a beach in Sri Lanka many years ago, and she's sadly no longer with us. But I'd like to think that Malathi is looking down from somewhere and very happy that we have managed to come together. I'm deeply honored to have had you on Countersign. Your work has been hugely influential on me, and you've been a really important inspiration. So thank you so much for giving me your time and joining me on Countersign.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Stuart, and bless the memory of Malathi de Alvis.
Thank you, David.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.